The Game Wardens got out of the truck, and they all, I mean, they looked like they were getting ready for war. Like, they got out, they were checking all their sidearms. Each one of them had a slung shotgun and a shotgun in their hand. And we get about, probably about 100 yards from the site, and they start yelling. They're all like, "Hey, bear, hey, bear, hey, bear." And I'm like, "Hey, guys, he's dead." They're like, "No, you don't understand. The last bear that we went on that was shot by a hunter, we got in there and there was 5 grizzlies eating on it."
Welcome to this week's episode, everybody. Thanks for tuning in, and we're getting there. We're almost at 1,000 downloads for the episode, so that's kind of a small milestone compared to everybody else, but definitely excited. Big win for me, and this podcast really resonates with me due to the fact that this is why I started doing all this, because I feel like you guys are going to get a lot of good knowledge and help out of this. You know, I'm doing this to help you guys. And our guest today reached out and said, hey, I want to help these guys. Help them help me, in a sense. But I've got Joel Swecker with me today from Black River Taxidermy. And he reached out to me and says, hey, you know, I like what you guys are doing over there. And, you know, I see some need for some information. And I agree with him because I've been in that scenario where you get a trophy of a lifetime or something you want to preserve on the wall and show for many years to come. And I ended up having to call a buddy and be like, how do you keep out a buck? So that's a real thing. And I know there's people out there similar like that, and don't be ashamed of it, because you really don't know until you're in that situation. So without further ado, I've got Joel with me, and allow you to introduce yourself.
Yeah, thank you. Thanks for having me on the podcast. Well, my name is Joel Swecker. As he said, I'm the owner-operator of Black River Taxidermy. Born and raised in Rochester, Washington. Never thought I would continue to live here, and here I be. So I'm a full-time fireman. This became a hobby years and years and years ago. Turned into a part-time, then a pretty much a full-time thing now. I am an avid hunter. I was a big-time waterfowler for a long time till kids came around. Like blacktails, I would give everything up though to hunt elk, man. I love chasing elk, especially Roosevelts in Western Washington. So this was a good avenue, part-time gig, and so here I be.
Thanks again for inviting me out here. Yeah. You got an awesome shop here, man. This is like I was telling when I walked in. This is like the ultimate man cave, but it comes and goes and always changes.
Yeah.
How long ago, you know, like, why did you get into taxidermy for one? You said it was maybe something to create a little bit of extra fun money. But was there, you know, what was the story behind that?
Yeah. So I always, ever since I was like a little kid, I was kind of always into trapping, skinning, stuff like that. I think just, you know, a lot of kids that grew up around here were kind of into some of that stuff. And I wanted something that was going to be, I wanted a part-time job on the side of firefighting. And I've always considered taxidermy even since I was younger. In my high school years, I was really big into like chalk drawings and pencil drawings. I drew a lot of elk, a lot of horses, stuff like that. So I think there was a little bit of an artistic side to that. As I got older, I was really entertaining the idea of doing taxidermy, and kind of the caveat to it, or the turning point, was with 3 guys that I hunt with big time, elk hunt with. We had gone on every year our families go to a cabin up in Packwood, and we kind of spend a week up there and hang out around the fire and stuff. And I hadn't even told them that I was interested in taxidermy. And they got on to the subject at the time. There was, I think, a couple taxidermists that quit doing it. There's another taxidermist locally that was talking about retiring. There's another guy that quit because of health reasons. And so they were saying, yeah, there's not a lot of them around. And some of the other ones are kind of hard to get a hold of and things like that. And so I looked at my wife and I'm like, I'll take that as a sign. So I started mentoring under a guy about a year or two later. His name was Tony Pancook. Some of you guys probably may have heard of him, but he was an avid outdoor writer. He was about as close to a professional hunter as you can get, hunted all over the U.S. And he did taxidermy. He got into taxidermy to basically mount his own stuff up so he didn't have a big bill at the end of the day. And so I mentored under him for a couple of years. He got to the point where he said, I can't teach anymore. We need to go to taxidermy school. So I went
kicked you out the door.
Yeah, kicked me out the door. And so I He passed away a couple years ago on a moose hunt, actually, in Canada. So I miss him terribly, but I'm sure I would still be hanging out with him to this day. But I ended up signing up for, there's several schools all over. The one I chose is Montana School of Taxidermy in Helena, Montana. I went there. I spent almost 2 months, 6 days a week, basically putting stuff on forms. I did birds, fish, the habitat, big game, all that kind of stuff, tanning. One thing that I liked about that school is they taught you tanning along with just the taxidermy aspect of it, which a lot of schools do not. And then I came home and opened Black River Taxidermy. I think that was in 2014, and it's been blowing up since. So it's the Pacific Northwest is a tremendous place to be a taxidermist because we get everything. Mm-hmm. We get whitetails, we get muleys, and then we get the coup de grace, the blacktails. You know, you would be surprised how many East Coasters are like, man, you're so lucky you get Roosevelts and blacktails. And so it's awesome. I absolutely love it. So
yeah, and we got a diverse fish, you know, yeah. Pheasants, waterfowl. We have some of the most diverse waterfowl in the whole state. I think the West Coast has got like most of the species. Like mm-hmm. there's 42, but we've got most of the 42 out of anything. And there's a lot of people that come here just to finish off their slam. You know, that's kind of a new thing for waterfowlers. Like right. Everybody can shoot limits every single day.
Yeah.
But now let's put a little bit more on selecting. I'm gonna go after common goldeneye or Barrows, Harlequin, all that stuff.
Yeah.
And I actually went to school with one of Tony's grandsons.
Yeah.
And I've been out to his house and everything, and he's a phenomenal guy.
Yeah.
He always sold us. He's like, if you ever want to get into the outdoor industry, start writing. And he's like, write about it, whatever you guys do.
Yep.
I kind of feel like this might be the new writing almost a little bit. You know, there's still magazines out there that need articles and tech tips, but I think this is kind of a new age outdoor writing in a sense.
Yeah. And that's not to go off on a tangent, but that's what Tony always told me. Mm-hmm. And so that I don't know if you want to call it a curse or a blessing, but I have a problem with apex predators as well as just weird scenarios that happen to me. So I started writing from years ago. And so I've had an article already in Bugle, and then they contacted me the day and they wanted another article. So there'll be an article in the upcoming one, I think in fall. That will be in there. And so that was to Tony's legacy a little bit. I've kind of taken that out, and that's been kind of fun too.
That's awesome. I have like a rough draft written up of one of the biggest blacktails that I've killed. It was a 2-year journey of going from harvesting the first inch of horn that was available to specifically targeting a buck, and then even going to the point of this deer is my goal. And I even got to the point where it was almost after I had accomplished and harvested this great animal and had history with, it was just like, now what do I do? That's serious. Like, I was like, this is why I went hunting. Now how do I get it going again?
Right.
So I do have a rough draft for that. One of these days I'll probably finish it, but I am on the same boat as you. And, it's just trying to find time with everything in the life. And I've got two kids now, and I'm sure you know
I got two of my own. Yep.
It takes up a lot of your time. So your extra time is pretty precious. And so with going through all of this, you know, you had a mentor get into it. I've always told my brother to start up his own taxidermy so that he can start doing ours, because you know, it is a addiction of ours.
Yeah.
But when did you finally, you know, get to the point, you know, because I'm sure it's a little bit of you're taking people's memories in, and then at a certain point you're like, all right, you know, we've figured this out, let's get it going. Because I even thought about start doing some like waterfowl, because we shoot a bunch of them, and it's just like, you know, $325 a bird.
Mm-hmm.
It's a lot of birds.
Mm-hmm.
Typically average price. But when did you get to the point where you were like, all right, I've got this, we're getting it going, and this is something I'm proud of.
I think a couple of years, you know, when you get back from taxidermy school, I had put quite a few animals on the form under Tony's direction and a few others. And I think once you get back from school, you know, under school, you're under the tutelage of someone else. So they're kind of looking over your shoulder, you know, and every species is different. You know, a blacktail scent gland is going to be sickled down different than a mule deer, and versus a whitetail, eye shape is going to be different. Ear format's going to be different, all that kind of stuff. So I think when you get back from school, it's very daunting.
I can imagine.
You're just like, I remember the first, it was actually a blacktail that I shot, a really nice one. I don't have them out here, but big, heavy 3. And I wanted to put them on a form. And here I am with the cape that I tanned. here I am with the form and the eyes, and I'm like, oh, crap.
Making phone calls.
Right. And I think a lot of it is just diving into it. To kind of answer your question as far as when you get comfortable and you're just like, this is really taking off. I don't want to say I'm comfortable doing anything, but I think it with most good professions, and especially with an artistic eye, I think there's always, I am my own worst critic. Mm-hmm. I will look at every single animal, and the coolest thing about this job is having someone come in and see it after that they've harvested it and see it on the wall, and they are just, you know, they love it. To me, there's nothing wrong with that mount, but I'm like, I would have done that different. So I think that comfortable stage probably came about 2 years after I was doing it commercially, where I had several hundred animals under my belt, to where it really got fluid. And a lot of that is just study your subject matter, man. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think being a hunter makes me a better taxidermist. And I think being a taxidermist makes me a better hunter. I find myself now when I'm elk hunting and I have those close calls, like what we were talking about before we lit this thing up, you know, that I see animals when they come in close, and I'm now no longer like, oh, that's a cool cow. Now I see, boy, she's holding her ears kind of cool. Oh, look how she's holding her. Yeah, that's kind of a cool pose. And so then that reflects in the work that comes back here. Same with blacktails is your, oh man, he's really pinning his ears back. He's ticked about something. Or look at the wrinkle he's got at the end of his nose. So that's what's kind of cool aspect of being a hunter and being a taxidermist. So.
Yeah, you can kind of perfect it over as time goes on.
Yes.
You know, I know exactly what you're talking about coming from like carpentry.
Yes.
I can walk into a room that we just remodeled and be like, yeah, you know, this spot, that's, they don't see any of that.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
And you know, you're, you know, like that was what my uncle said. Don't ever point out your own mistakes.
Right.
And, you know, I'm sure you do a great job of everything that I've seen, but I've also seen a trend where these pack boards,
these are
a big thing, but I'm sure it's probably kind of hard to find.
Oh, these things are, they've become a cult. The pack board mounts have become really big. You're right. The hardest thing now is find the pack boards. The good thing is I have a good friend that does rough cut plaques. And I told him, I said, hey, if you want to get into something making money, you need to make these pack boards. But listen, here's the deal. You have to make them rustic. I mean, all the metal, everything has to be rusted. Mm-hmm. And so he came over and those pack boards up on that shelf, he made those.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah. And I mean, they are completely rusted out. I mean, they are awesome looking. So, but yes, to answer your question, the pack board animals, that is tremendous.
That is a cool deal.
Yeah.
I think you did one of my friends, Zach Brotherton.
Yeah, I done a couple of his. A bear and a buck. Yeah.
So he was telling me, he's going to check this out. I'm like, yeah, man, that's cool. He actually, I think he found his own pack board.
Yes.
I think he like $20 at a garage sale or something like that. It happens.
For anybody listening, man, if you find like, especially the old like Trapper Nelsons, so the World War II packs, like that buck right over there, you can find those fairly easy, but a lot of people don't want those. That client right there, he brought that in. That was his dad, so he want that put on there.
Okay.
And that's awesome. But people don't want those. They want like the one like this bear is on. They want the old Trapper Nelson. Man, you find those anywhere under $100, grab it. I mean, because they're worth it.
Yeah.
Even if they're not real stable, I mean, they're getting harder. You go to look on eBay, you can find them on eBay, but they're like $200+.
Man.
But those are becoming big.
That's a pretty cool deal.
Yeah.
And hold on to them in case one day you do need it.
Absolutely.
And then do you do all your, like your own woodwork and everything for pedestals and shadow boxes or whatever, if anybody does that stuff? So
yeah, kind of, it depends on each contract, how it is. It depends on the customer's requests. I think in the Pacific Northwest, I think because of the logging industry that we have, a lot of people are really drawn to that rough cut cedar look. And then you can tell in here, I also have a lot of burnt cedar, and people really like that look against most mounts, especially Europeans. They look good against Europeans because it really offsets that white. I do a lot of that, but there's also some things that I have to source out, whether it be to another guy or some of the supply houses will sell something that's like a shadow box or something that is... Me ordering it and getting it here is going to be way cheaper and less time consuming than trying to do it myself. And in the long run, a lot of times it saves the client money too. So,
and one thing I'm really impressed with is that you're doing your own tanning.
Yes.
From at least the small experience of taxidermy that I've seen, not a lot of taxidermists, no shame on anybody, but a lot of times they ship them off.
Correct. There's a majority of the tanning for the shoulder mounts, for the deer, elk, moose, any of those animals, I will do in-house. Bears, cats, things of that nature, I will send off. Okay. And the reason why is because that's an entirely, I know how to do them. I've done them, but that there's a different chemical process that's involved with those because of the amount of grease and oils they have on their hides. I can send them off. It's kind of the same thing. At the end of the day, it will take me less time to send it off, and therefore I can take more intake.
Okay.
And it's also cheaper for me to do it, and it comes back and they're phenomenal. I mean, then they have a lot of it is I don't have some of the equipment that they have. I could get it, but this shop would have to be significantly bigger to have it.
Oh, okay.
So the shoulder mounts, I like doing them here because one, I know they're done correctly. Two, it's less time consuming. I can have a cape. There's numerous ways of tanning a cape, and there's wrong ways and there's correct ways. Mm-hmm. And I can correctly tan a cape in 5 days.
Oh,
and
wow.
Yeah, I can have one done from start to finish, from the green cape, as we call it, like fresh right off the head, to the tanning ready to put on a mount. I can have it done in 5 days. So I'll do them in batches for that month, you know, for, so okay. What we talked about before, you know, I've got all these new blacktails that are getting ready to hit the form. And so I'll do all that batch for this month. They'll hit the form. And then, you know, I'll get all those out of the freezer, tan them, and they'll be ready to go.
Yeah, I didn't know it was that efficient in a sense.
Yeah.
Now, do you do all your own, basically, ungulates? Is it more of a quality control deal? Or, I mean, is it the same situation with bears where technically, yeah, you could save some money and do all that, but it seems like you can do it faster and you can do it under your watch.
Yeah, bears are different because you can't do one of those in 5 days because there's a degreasing process.
Okay.
Which some of the chemicals they use for degreasing, you have to soak it for a minimum of 3 days before it's going to adequately pull those greases and stuff out. Then it has to go into another bath. The other thing too is that bears and some of those other species like cats and things like that, they'll put in a huge tumbler. It's essentially a dryer on steroids that's 10 feet tall.
Wow.
And so once they tan it, they will throw it in there with a bunch of pine shavings, and it literally pulls all the nasty stuff out of there. And then the shavings fall out the bottom that have attached it themselves to the fat and everything else, and the hide comes out. It's what they call broken too. It's nice and soft. And then, you know, you get a few people every year that call you as a taxidermist. They're like, hey, I want to tan my own hide. And it's like, dude, you don't know what you're getting into.
Yeah.
Don't, you know, and it's usually not a rabbit or something. It's usually a bear or a cow. And I'm like, oh my gosh, you don't even do it, man. I'm not even joking. You know, and one thing I tell them is, by the time you get done, that hide will be so rock hard. I don't care what you're doing. You're not going to get it. You have to have a tumbler and some pieces of machinery that most people don't have.
Yeah.
So it's, you know, there's just kind of that. But you're right. And then a lot of taxidermists do not do their own tanning. They send it off.
Now, does that add, say taxidermy in general, sending it off? I mean, does it add a lot of the lead time that we see? Or is it just, you know, because a lot of these guys are inundated? Because there's some taxidermists that are like, 2-3 years out.
Yeah.
And there's some taxidermists that'll turn them around pretty quick.
Sure.
A lot of it's usually inventory and quality and all that, I'm sure. But
yeah, I got to be careful because I don't want to speak for other taxidermists.
Yeah.
But generally the question, yes, a lot of time it's convenience.
Okay.
A lot of them do not know, or they don't want to have the time to tan their own stuff. Some of the really big taxidermy, I mean, like warehouse size in like Vegas and stuff, where basically you send them everything. They will have their own department of tanning where they have people that's all they do.
Gotcha.
The lead time, and we can probably get into that later. There's a whole bunch of different reasons why the lead time. As far as tanneries, like once you send a hide off, depending on what tanner you send it to, you're looking at anywhere from 3 to 8 months to get it back, which is a pretty standard time. To get a hide back. And part of that reason is most of these tanneries, you know, I'll send them, you know, 100 bears a year. Well, they've got thousands of bears in there. So, and they do it as time comes in. And that also kind of ties into one of the biggest complaints with taxidermist people is how long it takes. And that's one thing that most people don't understand is that you're taking 95% of your inventory in within a month and a half time. And there's just simply, you can't get all that done in that amount of time. A lot of times during the month of October, when blacktails really start flowing in, September, you get elk in, when they start coming in, and then October, you get the blacktails in. Most stuff, the first contracts that come in, they're usually out the door pretty quick. 4 to 6 months or less.
And when you mean contracts, sorry to interrupt you.
Contracts, just animals. Okay. So, okay. Yeah. So I refer to it, and each animal is a contract. I don't know why. I just...
No, just explaining it, because if I'm thinking like, what's a contract? Yeah, I'm sure there's some other people thinking, what's a contract?
Yeah, so...
And you probably have to send them in batches. They can't just send one and send one back. It wouldn't be feasible. So you got to get a little bit and business needs. Yep. So let's get into some of the common mistakes that you see as a taxidermist, because that's kind of the why we're doing a lot of this.
Right.
Is we want to hopefully prevent that, and for their sake and your sake, because we want them to be able to have, you know, the same hide and do all that stuff. But what are some of the things that you want to tell us? Like, hey, guys, all
right. Right.
Square one. This is what we need to think about, and this is the process we need to do. Because typically for me, in my situation, if I'm going to bring a head in, I'm going to cape it because I somewhat know how to cape it. I might be actually doing it wrong. I'm going to ask you. But I bring it up to a bit about the knuckle and the head where the spinal cord attaches to the skull. I take it out there, and I don't touch anything else. I wrap the cape up, leave the head and skull, meet everything on there, and I take it into a taxidermist. Now that's my scenario. I see guys on videos and all that stuff that will take the whole process through. Mm-hmm. Walk us through the basic steps on how to preserve, you know, your trophy, and kind of go through the species. You know, bears coming up here in a couple weeks. August 1 opens.
Yeah, yeah.
So,
and you see some of the biggest mess ups with those. We can even go back one step further and say, you know, even if you don't have a taxidermist in mind, try and find a taxidermist, do your work.
That was going to be my next question. Let's start with that. How do you pick a taxidermist?
Okay. So the general public needs to understand there's two different kinds of taxidermy. There's commercial taxidermy, which is what this is. And then there's show taxidermy. Okay. Where guys are competing on a national level or international level, and commercial taxidermy is not show taxidermy. You have some guys that do phenomenal work, and it looks tremendous, but compared to like show quality taxidermy, it's nothing. Like show quality, they will spend 8 hours on an ear, on one ear, just doing it. You know, they want the vein lines and everything else. So guys that compete in show generally still do commercial stuff, and that makes them better because they see some of the finer details. So as far as choosing your taxidermist, you know, one thing you always want to start with references. You know, hey man, I saw your black tail on the wall, thing looks good, who did that? You know, oh hey, here, so you know, here's this guy. Before you, that's the thing that's kind of surprising to me, is guys will go on, you know, I had a gentleman bring in an elk a couple years ago, and he paid, I'm not even going to say it, an astronomical amount of money for this bull. No taxidermist lined up. You know, you'll spend hundreds or tens of thousands of dollars on these hunts, or even lots of worth, you know, you're a blacktail guy. Mm-hmm. You're spending countless hours in the woods following these bucks, gas money, food, trail cameras, everything else. But then it always surprises me when people are like, oh, I didn't know what I was going to do with it afterwards, you know? So always good to start with references. The best thing is call a taxidermist before the season hits. And there's two reasons why you want to do that. One, you want to talk to him and see if he's going to be able to accept it. Because a good taxidermist will be busier than he knows what to do with. And then secondly, you want to go see his work. With tech these days, I'm not a technology guy. I know how to turn a computer on. I can access the internet and stuff like that. But you can Photoshop anything.
Yeah.
So I've seen some taxidermists that they Photoshop the heck out of it, and their stuff looks really good online. And I've seen it in person. It's just like, you know. So you want to go and look at their stuff. Look at their stuff in process. Look at their stuff on the wall. Look at that kind of stuff. And then check their prices. You know, expensive doesn't always mean good. And cheap doesn't always mean bad either. But typically a rule of thumb is you get what you pay for.
Yeah.
That's a rule of thumb. So that would be kind of my tip to anybody looking for a taxidermist is, you know, go through those kind of steps. But the big thing is to go meet the guy and see his stuff in process.
Because one thing I've seen is some stuff looks really good at one angle.
Yeah.
And at other angles, they don't. But, you know, is that something that's acceptable in a sense? I mean, you got a certain pose, or like, how does that work? The biggest thing I'm seeing that in is in waterfowl.
Yeah.
Because waterfowl, they'll be cupped up coming one way and they're like, oh, it looks good. And you go look from the side and you're like, oh, what's going on there?
Oh, we know what side I got shot on. No, it kind of depends. Oh, that's kind of a double-edged sword, because it kind of depends on what side the taxidermist really wanted to pay attention on.
Okay.
It depends on what kind of equipment he was working on. Maybe he had a stand that he couldn't see the bad side, or the side that didn't turn out as good as well. It also could be, you know, I will have clients that will bring in an animal and you'll have one side that's pretty poorly chewed up.
Okay.
And we're like, hey, let's pose it to the other side so you don't see that near as much. So there's a couple different reasons why that can happen. And you're absolutely right. One side, the other thing too, is that sometimes you can see a deer next to another deer and it's two different taxidermists, and you don't see like what, until you see the two next to it and you're like, whoa, big difference.
I hope you just understand these questions are coming from somebody that's never been.
Oh yeah.
I've had one deer taxidermied, but, just coming from, you know, it's not somebody trying to badmouth or anything, but
no,
these are just questions that are coming to me, because I've seen that, and I'm just like, I don't know if that's normal, you know, because the pose is going one direction, so we're kind of focused on that direction, which I get sometimes, you know, they get tore up or something happens,
right?
Or, you know, maybe a person doesn't know how to quarter a deer, has to drag something out.
Yeah.
That's definitely a possibility.
That's a big no-no. We'll talk about that one later on.
That's definitely a possibility. So what are some red flags, like, say you're going to reach out and try and find a taxidermist, something like, yeah, I don't know if I should probably do that. Not trying to throw anybody on the bus, but just for people
not at
to...
all. You know, I think some of the red flags would be, they can't give you... Now, understand that in taxidermy, in the world of taxidermy, especially in the last couple of years with COVID, oh my goodness. With COVID-19, I really am happy with a lot of my turnaround times. With that said, the last couple of years have been astronomically horrible. When COVID started hitting, then you heard of different avenues of business that were being affected by supply and stuff. I thought, well, taxidermy won't ever be affected. Oh yeah, it did big time. Plywood is through the roof, wood's through the roof. And the reason why is because the epoxies and glues they're using. Well, guess what? Those same epoxies and glues are using our forms.
Really?
So, oh yeah. So,
oh, no.
So like form companies. So first the tannery shut down because they said you couldn't have a certain amount of people in there. So they shut down. And then when they came back online, they couldn't buy chemicals. And then by the time they started getting chemicals, the taxidermy supply houses were like, we can't get anybody to pour forms because everybody's off.
Yep.
Not here. And now we can't get them to come back in. And by the time they got them to come back in, the epoxies and glues are through the roof. So we're all getting notified. All of us taxidermists who have all of our contracts in for the year are getting notifications from the taxidermy supply houses saying, oh, guy, guess what? Your forms are going up 17%. So, but the red flags to kind of where I'm going with that is that generally a taxidermist should be able to give you a general timeline.
Yeah.
First line in my contract when you come in and sign it is I have not been promised a completion date. That's not to scare anybody. That's to protect me as well as the client. Yeah. Now people there are, and I'm not, you know, again, we're not trying to point anything out, but there are taxidermists. I know I have a close friend who had work in with a taxidermist. It was in there for 7 years.
It's crazy.
Yeah, it's crazy. So anybody that can't give you at least a general idea of what you're looking at, I would be leery, because that means that they either don't know how many they've got or something like that. And I don't mean general. I don't mean to the day or the month. I mean within a 6 month period, they should be able to tell you when that's when that's looking at being done. Another red flag is, you know, if you go and visit them, and you know, you see the work in process. If it's something that you don't like, I would if you kind of get some of those gut feelings, then I wouldn't. You know, I just look into it more before you'd commit to them. Pricing isn't really necessarily that. Again. It just, you have to look at their work and determine what you're happy with.
Just thinking, speaking of pricing, what is somebody that hasn't gotten taxidermy done before, doesn't really know a rough estimate? How does that whole work? You know, as far as pricing, you deposits, you bring your animal in, like, how does that all transpire?
Yeah. So, I mean, again, every taxidermist is different.
Okay.
Me, I can tell you where I'm coming from. And so I have a set price, and I don't mind saying it on the podcast, but so like a deer shoulder mount, a standard deer shoulder mount is $650 for a standard deer shoulder mount. There's a little bit of tax on top of that. And then I require a 25% deposit due when you drop it off. I didn't used to take deposits. The problem is that every now and then, and I get asked this question quite a bit, is how many times does it happen where people just, you never hear from them again? And it's extremely rare.
Well, yeah.
I mean, in the last 7-8 years, I think I've only had 2 times that's ever happened. And actually both those times they came back, I boxed their stuff up because I'm like, I don't want to sell it. You know,
yeah.
What happened? This is someone's trophy, but I have legal right to sell it. And I box it up, and 6 months later out of the blue, they call up and they're like, hey, we want to come pick our bear up, or hey, we want to, you know, so it's like,
I've been calling you about your extended warranty. You know?
Yeah. So it's pretty rare for that to happen, but a lot of times the deposits are to cover the tanning costs and the form costs, the out of pocket stuff that we're going to endure first. In all honesty, with good taxidermy work, you would be surprised if you were to really count the hours that a taxidermist has into it. Taxidermy is relatively inexpensive compared to how many hours they'll actually put into it. Now there are some people that charge, I know of one guy that charges more for a deer shoulder mount than I do an elk shoulder mount. You know, and there are those out there. But generally the prices are fairly similar around across the board. So that's why you have to be careful in who you're choosing, because some of it looks really good and some of it can be not what you're looking for. So,
yeah. And what, 25% is around 150, 200 bucks.
Yeah.
So you plan, guys.
Yep.
Plan it out.
Plan it out. And then if you're with bear people, you see it a lot where someone will get a bear down. So like a full mount bear, they're expensive. You know, you'll have 60 hours into a full mount bear.
Stand up full bear.
Yeah, it doesn't matter if they're on all fours or they're standing up a full bodied anything is really expensive. Full body cougar. You know, most of the time with those type of animals, either a bear or a cougar, you see a lot of people in the hunting season that are out for deer. They see a bear, they know they have a bear, they shoot it, they're jacked up because they got their first bear, and they come in and they're like, oh man, I didn't realize how much, you know. Mm-hmm. Usually most full mounts, I'll do 50% down. For those, just because usually the cost of the forms on any full mount, I mean, you know, you can buy a deer shoulder mount for most supply houses for $75. Yeah. You know, you have some other costs involved in that, but the eyes and the thread and everything else, but you buy a full body deer mount and it's like $600.
Jeez.
So, I mean, it does not cost them that to pour those forms, but the market is held by a couple companies. So that's where the full mounts, you know, most people are not prepared for what those full mounts cost. But yeah, most time it's 50% down for those.
Okay. What about rugs? Because I know rugs aren't cheap either.
Yep.
And I'm looking to do some bear hunting. So what would be is it price per foot, I think?
Yeah. So most people do price per foot. I'm $200 a linear foot. I'm pretty inexpensive compared to some. A lot of guys will do a lot more than that. I usually do 25% down on those.
Okay.
Bears, any bear work. Well, I should take that back. So cats and stuff is 25%. Any bear work is 50% down, just because of the cost of the tanneries and everything else. So it just kind of depends. And then your price can go up and over. That's one thing, is a lot of times people don't realize when you get a bear, decide whether you want an open mouth or closed mouth, because there's usually a significant difference between the two. And you can really change. There's about $150, $200 per extra for an open mouth rug. But I mean, we can talk about that a little bit later too, but there's certain things you can do to accentuate that bear. If you got a bear with a big old noggin on him, a lot of people want the open mouth forms, but the problem is when you're looking at this bear on the floor or on the wall, wherever you have it, your eye is drawn naturally to that open mouth and they look cool, but you're going to lose the size of that head with an open mouth because the jaw is going to draw the head forward. It's going to narrow the back of the noggin down.
Yep.
Whereas if you do a closed mouth rug, man, you got a span between the ears. I mean, you can see that pumpkin and they're cool looking, especially if you got a big old noggin on him. So, you know,
and one thing that I know we do with taxidermy and waterfowl, because Seth Lane does all of mine and my brother's, he's damn good.
Yeah.
What we'll do is we don't have to put deposits down because we've sent him so many things, but
yep.
Something to think about, guys. If you drop a bear off, you know, you have some time.
Mm-hmm.
Throw $50, $100. I'm sure you're fine with that.
Yep.
Keeping track of that. So you don't, might be a big price tag, but that's something you can knock down as you get going.
Yeah.
So that's something coming from me and how I deal with, you know, birds and waterfowl and other stuff. Put your deposit down, get it going, and then, you know, commit $100 a month until it, say, it comes home, that'll knock down the price and you don't have to fight with your wife about pulling $1,200 or something out.
That's a funny story because I've had guys come in here before and they'll come racing in and they'll jump out of the truck, come running in, and I hear another car door open, you know, and it's the wife. And they'll come in and be like, dude, quick, quick, quick. And they're slipping me $300. Don't tell her what I spent on this.
Can I get that gift receipt?
Right. No, that's the thing is that you will leave most good taxidermy shops, whether you put a deposit down or not. And you're right. Usually all new clients, there's no exceptions. I will take a deposit because with every new client, I'm taking a chance. Usually I have guys that have been here for 7 years. And if they come in and it's just more of a convenience thing, hey man, I just don't have my wallet. I'm like, or I don't have my cash. I mean, no big deal, dude. We'll figure it out.
We'll square up.
Yes. But yeah, yeah, absolutely. I have guys that do that quite a bit. They'll call up and they'll be like, hey, I want to do $100 down over the phone, credit card or whatever like that. Yeah, that's no problem. A lot of times I don't like people paying all up front for a project. And the reason why I say that is because very, very, very rarely something can happen. And then I'm like, eh. Yeah. You know, I got to refund all that money. It's more of a convenience thing for me. I don't have any problem refunding the money if something goes bad.
Yeah.
But sometimes I don't like doing that. At least, you know, I like, let's square up when we get done and we'll do it then.
Well, I deal with a lot of fraud in my job.
Sure.
And I have this conversation with people after the fact is like, you know, if you, not saying that it's bad to pay all up in front, but I deal with like a lot of contractors.
Right.
Imagine if you paid this giant amount up front.
Yep.
Now, let me explain it to you. Like, what if on January 1, you know, the state cuts me a check for my whole salary?
Yeah.
Your incentive's a little bit gone.
Absolutely.
Not necessarily usually in taxidermy because, you know, taxidermists do have the artistic touch. They love doing what they're doing, seeing the project through. But something to think about.
Well, and that's a lot of time, to be completely honest with you, too, that's a lot of times why I take a deposit. Mm-hmm. You know, for a long time, you would have people that bring in a bear and all they want is the hide tanned. And the tannery that I was using before, there was nothing due until the project was done. The tannery I'm using now, they want everything all up front. And so I would have these people before, it was just, there's just labor into it. Mm. So I wouldn't take a deposit. What I found out is that unless someone had money into the project, it was really hard to get them to come back to pay in full.
Not bad.
So as long as they've got some cards in the game, then they're usually a lot quicker to come back and be, and that's just a business thing. That's nothing against anybody. That's just how it is, you know? So yeah, absolutely.
Well, so we kind of narrowed down, you know, picking your taxidermist, you know, go check them out, call them on the phone, check out a couple different taxidermists, see where their lead times and kind of find the one that fits you. You know, if you're like, hey, I don't care about time. It doesn't really matter to me. You know, there's guys out there that are years out.
Yes.
You know, if you are just looking to get a first deer or anything like that, you can look, you can shop around for something that might be quicker.
Right.
But there's some things to keep in mind with all that.
Right.
So let's kind of segue into, getting your animal to the shop.
Right.
What are some things to think about? Let's start with bear.
Yep.
Because bear's coming up quickest. August 1st is rolling around. It's going to be hot.
Mm-hmm.
What are some of the things that you see out there that, you know, that are no-nos and some things that we can give some people some information on how to prevent some possible hard conversations to have.
Yeah. So out of all the mistakes I see in taxidermy, the two that I see is elk and bear. And bear, it's usually catastrophic bad. Bear are a carnivore. I mean, they're trash pandas, man. I mean, they'll eat anything.
Yeah.
So they carry an insane amount of bacteria on them. One, because they're long-coated. Two, because they have an insane amount of fat on them. And three, because of their diet. They will eat a rotten salmon and they'll go and eat mushrooms 30 minutes later. So a lot of times what you see with bears is that people don't get them into cooling quick enough. So that the hides will start slipping. And slipping is a term that we use, and you'll hear that in taxidermy, to meaning that the biodegradable process starts to happen on a cellular level in the hide and the hair just comes right out. So they called it slipping years ago is because a guy would basically slip his hand over a hide and the hair would just come right out. Now, you're going to have that with any animal to some degree. I mean, what I mean is don't freak out when you go and run your hand over a bear hide and you have a couple hairs on your hand. That's not slipping yet. Slipping is when like it comes out and it's
chunks.
Bear, chunks and there's exposed hide. So people, a lot of times with bears is one, they don't know quite what they're going to do with it as far as caping it or the cuts that they're going to make. I always say if you're going, again, we said it earlier, is that a lot of times when people shoot bear, unless they're specifically bear hunting, a lot of times that's a surprise. So know your cuts, know how to cut those correctly. And there's all kinds of diagrams. I'm going to put some on the Facebook page and the Instagram page as August 1st rolls around, so you can kind of see. So know what you want to do with that, or think about an idea what you want to have with that, and then have the proper equipment to get that animal out and get it cooled off quickly. Bears have one of the most, I just did a thing on Facebook the other day, a video about bear hunting, and I had a bear in here that a gentleman brought in. He salted it. The head was still in it. The paws were still in it, but he salted the rest of the hide, and all the fat was still on it. So no matter what you do, you're not doing anything with that salt, because that fat is so thick and so dense, you're not going to permeate it.
It's not getting there.
Yeah. So, you know, there's simple mistakes like that. One of the big things I see is that people will skin a bear and they won't let it cool off. Get it to a shop floor or get it someplace out of the sun and let it open up and let it cool off before you roll it up.
How many hours would you say?
It just kind of depends on the bear and how big the bear is. Don't work on getting all the fat off. I mean, try and get as much as you can, but don't get it down to the pedicle, because you're going to blow through the hide is what you're going to do.
Okay.
Keep that, you know, keep some of the fat on the viscera, but skin it relatively good like a deer. And then let it cool off, lay it out, let it cool off before you roll it up. And then preferably, especially if it's a big bear, you know, 5.5 or bigger, don't roll it up and put it in a freezer. I had a gentleman a couple years ago, went to British Columbia, shot a couple of big bears. He shot, I think it was like one of them was like a 7'10". The other one was like a 6'8".
Black bear?
Yeah. Yeah. They were monsters. They got it back to camp. They skinned the bear. They immediately rolled it up and threw it in the freezer. The problem is that is the best insulation God ever made. So the middle of that roll on that bear is not going to freeze for 3 or 4 days.
Oh.
And so what happened was is when it came into me, I unrolled it, I fleshed it. I didn't see any problem with it. I had a couple red flags, some smell and stuff, but it wasn't something terribly. I didn't see any slipping, but I didn't tug everywhere either. I mean, it's a 6'8" bear. Send it to the tannery. Tannery calls me and he's like, dude, this thing's slipping all over. And when I got the hide back, he sent me the hide back anyway. And I took the claws out for the client. The bear was literally slipping exactly where the middle of that roll was, where they rolled it up. So make sure and cool it off before you just throw it in a cooler. Let it get ambient temperature. I'm not talking like ice down, but and put it in there and don't store it. Like if you're packing out too, don't put it in a plastic bag. That's all it's going to do. Yes. Put it in a meat bag, something like that. So bears, that's usually what you see. The other thing you see too is I call them the YouTube warriors. Mm-hmm. You know, you get someone that watches a YouTube video of someone caping a bear, and I mean caping like taking it all the way off the front of the face. Don't do that unless you've actually done it or unless you've talked to your taxidermist prior. Because majority of the times the people that do that and they get out in the field and they do it, they're going to screw it up. And they're going to cut the eye glands. They're going to cut around the lips. And then it's going to be tougher. Or you're going to incur potentially another cost with your taxidermist.
Yeah,
so
no
he's
kidding.
Going to be like, what? Did you skin this thing with a John Deere lawnmower?
Did you run this thing over?
So, yeah.
I'm not skilled enough to go down that route, even with deer. I mean, yeah. I know blacktails, those freaking glands, you can go so far in the skull.
Mule, they're even worse.
Yeah, that's what I noticed when I shot my buck this year. I'm like, what?
Yeah, they are deep.
Ends.
The only thing that's deeper than that is a elk. But and you can do those. A lot of guys, you know, I've spent years backcountry hunting for elk, you know, in Idaho and stuff like that. And it's valuable to know that. You just don't want to do that in the moment.
Take your time.
You know, yeah, take your YouTube video and then 2 years later you get a 300 class bull down, and you're like, man, I'd be able to shoulder mount this thing. Mm-hmm. And you haven't even attempted it. Now you're like, oh, let's go ahead and wing this.
Yeah.
And it's not gonna work. So
with bears, like say somebody's somewhere where they're backpacking in.
Sure.
Logan Road, probably a different situation. Backpacking in where they need to cape this animal, get the meat out. What you're saying is get the hide off.
Yeah.
Lay it out. Mm-hmm. Try and find some shade.
Right.
Let it cool down. Take care of the meat. Get everything packed up, ready. You maybe even, if you can, if the terrain allows, probably get that on the second trip. If you're taking one trip, put that in last.
Yep.
Allow it to cool down, get it in. And then what I do, at least in, when I'm hunting and I'm packing in, I'll take a pallet and put a pallet in the back of my truck and then like lay the meat on there so it can kind of get a little bit of airflow in
Absolutely.
There.
Absolutely.
So you're saying cool it down before you tie it all up. Now, one thing I wanted to ask you is like, if somebody is like, you know, at first bear, I don't really have the money to do a rug or say a full body mount.
Right.
What's the best way to store that for say a year or longer?
Yeah, that's a really good question. The best way to do that is if you go to like Home Depot or someplace sell those real thick black contractor bags, get one, could get a, one or two of those. Take the bear once it's cooled off, really well cooled off. Take the hide out, fold it flesh to flesh. So if you cut it like a typical rug where you've gone right up the belly and so it's opened up, you just basically fold one arm over onto the other arm. And so it just, you know, flesh to flesh. So there's pretty no flesh showing at that point. The best way to do it is to roll them up, but roll them up so that the head is on the inside of the roll. And the reason why you do that is because a lot of times what we see is these bears will come in from being in a freezer and they will, they'll have tremendous freezer burn to their nose. Yes, their nose, their ears, stuff like that. And it's not a deal breaker as far as it doesn't ruin the hide. Everybody says, oh, how long can it be in there before it's ruined? Well, it doesn't necessarily ruin. What happens is you get it to a point where you can't, it's a term we call turning, where we turn the lips, ears, and eyes. The lips, eyes, ears, everything gets turned inside out. And that allows us to basically get the fat out of the lips and around the eyes and ears and stuff. And so the tanning process can commence. If you can't turn that correctly, it is a huge bucket trying to get those things turned if they're freezer burned. So put the head on the inside. Don't leave your tag on the in the mouth of the bear like everybody, like every other person does. Take the tag out and attach it to the outside of the bag or something like that. Because when we take it to a taxidermist, we have to we have to write those numbers down.
Okay.
We don't need to see the tag necessarily. We're not law enforcement, but we need to at least have those numbers because we have to record all that stuff. And then wrap it up in one of those plastic bags. Make sure the hide doesn't have a lot of water on it. If it has a lot of water on it, it's gonna crystallize and it's gonna break some of those pedicles. And just roll it up, put it in there, and then if you can, double bag it. So I've had bears brought in. Well, that bear I just did the other day, it was stored in a gunny sack for 8 months. Head was on the outside. The thing looked like it'd been in the freezer for 20 years.
Lord.
I had a bear that was brought in a couple years ago. It had been in the freezer for 8 years. Well packaged, it was like that year's bear. It was perfect. So you can store that in that way. And usually those bears too, though, I mean, it's a big bag. If you get a 5 footer or better, it's, you're going to make some, you always get a run of, with taxidermy, you know, you get all your hunting season, you get all these stuff come in and then you get the surprises. What happens is you get another run, usually right about when special permits, like the draws stuff come out and you get someone like, oh, I got to get that in there. And then I call it the wife gets mad invoice, you know, where guys start talking about going hunting and the wife's like, hey, you got to get that stupid bear out of my freezer. So then you get another rush of them, right before hunting season. So, yeah.
Now, is there any... deer is going to be hard.
Yeah.
Unless you are skilled in keeping it out, like taking the face off.
Yeah. I honestly wouldn't recommend any of that. I'm actually talking about doing a class, like a 1 day class.
That's what I was going to say.
So I've actually talked about, I know the new owner of Lucky Shot. I was thinking about talking with him or talking to another outdoor place. And then the tough thing is trying to find animals that you can practice on. Without going into specifics, there is an alternative that we can do that where we can actually practice on animals, not necessarily horned animals, but we can do something like that. And I may offer that in the future where we're going to do a class where like, hey man, if you want to come learn how to take something off the head correctly and the tools to use it, let's do that. But yes, deer, unless you have done it and unless you're extremely proficient at it, don't do it. Or you're talking to your taxidermist. Because we honestly prefer, I have only a few clients that I know of personally that when they say, hey, I took it off the head, I'm comfortable with that.
Yeah.
Everybody else, I'm like, eesh. And usually it's warranted because then they come in and there's some pretty good cuts, you know, around the spots that are like the worst possible place you can make a cut on.
Okay.
So you want to, like you were saying earlier, with a deer, the best way to do it is to glove the whole thing, meaning that you go, what we see with deer and elk is pretty common. It's more so with elk, but with deer is that people don't come back far enough.
What do you mean by that?
Well,
from the back of the horns.
Yeah. So if you're doing like a standard shoulder mount, there's all, depending on what Google site you go to, people will tell you, oh, it's 4 inches behind the third rib. And dude, make it easy on you. Go all the way around the halfway of the body, mm-hmm. make a cut all the way around the halfway of the body. Where you see a lot of mess ups with deer is the brisket. So when an animal hits the ground, their brisket automatically slides down. So yeah. What happens is they try and get the littlest amount and they go right behind the shoulder and they come down and then they end up cutting up towards like the throat area and that black patch, especially in the blacktails, mm-hmm. they cut that off. And all the slack on a shoulder mount, that's where all the slack comes from. It's not the back, it's mm-hmm. the brisket.
Okay.
And so stay, you know, the best, that's why I tell everybody go all the way around. You know, go all around the midsection of the buck. If you can glove it forward, and that means basically just skin it up, don't make any other cuts, that's great. But
what about what about like on the front leg joint?
Yep.
Glove it up to that. Is that what you're saying as well? And then just ring around the ankle, or not the ankle, but that joint where you take it off? Or
yeah, the best way is go up to the knee, cut it around the circumference of the knee.
Yep.
And then if you can glove it, great. You know, let's be honest. You know, I'm a hunter too. These animals never die in the most convenience of spots. Mm. And so a lot of times you're forced to make cuts in order to get that cape off that animal correctly. If you have to make a cut, there's two hairlines on a deer. There's a hairline on the inside of the leg, mm-hmm. and there's a hairline on the very back of the leg.
Yeah.
Do the back leg.
Yeah. It's really noticeable.
Yes.
Because you have a lot of long hair.
Yep.
And then it'll go to the shorter hair. So it I would ring it and take, you follow that line.
Yep.
And you come.
Just go up to the, just stay out of the armpit. You don't want to get into the armpit.
Yeah.
So
you come up above it.
Yeah.
And then you're basically coming like literally center body.
Correct.
Correct.
Yep.
Thank God I'm doing it right.
Yeah.
Because my buddy's like, he's like, don't cut the brisket. Stay out of the armpit. And I'm just like, freaking trophy of a lifetime here. And I'm shaking. I'm like, I'm totally doing this wrong. But, and then you take that back to your circumference in the middle, and then you come up the spine. Correct. But you want to come down with the hair, or does it matter?
Yeah. One thing that should be said too is like tools. So
okay.
I have a lot of thing. I'm coming back to that in just a second. But before I go any further, that's one thing we should have started this off with was that, you know, make sure you guys are using like really, really sharp knives. I use a Havilon. I love them. I can change out a blade really well. I had an old knife that I carried around that my dad had, you know, and I understand the tradition behind that, and that's awesome. But when you're skinning an animal, use something really sharp, because when you cut that line around down the spine, or when you're gutting a deer, or when you're, you know, you're making the line up a black bear and it's jagged, man, it makes horrible when you sew it. I mean, it makes it even more, sometimes you have to go through and recut it, you know, to make it, so the seam is really good. So make sure you're doing that. But to answer your question, yeah, you want to, if you can, you know, if you have to, you can cut right down the back of the spine, and you want to go against the hair, but you want to stay underneath of it. So don't cut from the outside in, cut from the inside out. Does that make sense?
Like if you were to put your knife, you get your hand on your knife, you're going up the back of the neck. You want to go, if
underneath.
Anything, come down.
And yeah.
Because the neck can get kind of hard. You want to come from underneath and cut. Almost kind of towards you.
Yeah.
If you're going to, you know, because then you know what I'm talking about, when, especially in
absolutely.
Elk, when it gets a little tough, you can't really slide the knife through it.
Yeah. What you're essentially trying to do is keep from cutting the hair. Because if you cut the hair, that's extremely noticeable. And again, then a lot of times we have to go through and trim. And that doesn't sound like a big deal, but when you have a buck that, you have a blacktail buck that's got a 24 inch neck, and you want to show that off, but you've cut hair and now the taxidermist had to take half an inch on both sides. Well, guess what? He's now 23. And that doesn't sound like a big deal, but trust me,
it's a big deal.
In amount, it's a big deal. You'll notice a difference. So, okay.
One knife that I use the Havilon. It's just, I'm kind of a little strong handed.
Yeah. Yeah.
Break
you'll
them off.
Bust them off. Outdoor Edge is another good one.
So I use the Outdoor Edge one, but the one with the swing blade on the back, it's like
the gutter.
I don't know if it's a gutter, but
it's got the bold tip on the end of it.
It's got the thick tip of it.
Yep.
I love that thing. For if you're going to do a gutless method, you can go from the tail to the neck and up the arms like butter.
Right.
And then if you get down to it pretty quick, you don't even have to like cut anything.
Yep.
You just pull, because this deer is so hot.
Yep.
It'll take this hide right off of them.
Yeah. Go ahead.
I just saying, I love that knife.
Yeah. Yeah. Big mistake too with people with deer is they drag them someplace to get them someplace to skin them. If you were even thinking about doing a mount, don't drag your deer, even if it is over like, you know, the clear cuts, you know, they have logs, stuff like that. So let me tell you something. You can drag it and you'll get it up there and you're like, oh, it's fine. I'm still good for a shoulder mount. It's probably not. And here's why. Is you have busted the pedicles off below the hairline. You can't see. When we tan that deer, all that's coming out.
So you're talking, when you say pedicles, that means like the root of the hair.
Root of the hair. Yep. Okay.
So if you start messing with that, it makes for bad news.
Yeah. So I had a gentleman bring in a blacktail a couple years ago. Phenomenal deer. No, it was a whitetail. Phenomenal deer. Wanted to, he brought it in, wanted to do a shoulder mount, and he told me he'd drag it. And the cape looked okay, but I could kind of tell where it was muddled. When we tanned that thing up and I brought it out of the tanning tank, you could literally see the drag marks where gravel and stuff had come down and all the hair came out. So don't drag them. So even if you have to have a guy on each side, grab the antler and pick the shoulder area up and yard them that way, go for it, but don't drag them. So, cause it, unless you kill this thing on the golf course, you know, you're going to have some damage at the hair level. So,
and that kind of applies everything for elk as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, if you're dragging an elk, I want to get a hold of you.
I had to pull mine out of a creek
I need your number on speed dial come elk season if you're dragging an elk out.
Yeah. So, and then you were talking about the cut behind the horns. You know, because this, I'm going to tell you what I've looked online. I've kind of been told you come up to the neck, and if you had to, you would take like a Y to the back of the antlers.
Yeah.
I wouldn't mess with that knowing if I'm going to get it mounted. I'm not going to do that Y. I'm just going to do it just enough to get up where I can go around where the spine meets, I don't know the technical term of that joint.
So I'm a fireman. I'm an EMT. So the technical term is the magnum foramen, which is where the spine meets the back of the skull. And there's a big hole. You can feel on deer, elk, anything, even a bear, you can feel that notch on the back of the skull. Okay. And you know, if you come up there, stop. Now, if you have a bull that's got a big knotty, you know, big cartilage and stuff back there, essentially you want to stop a couple inches before the ears. So, usually when I make that cut to the Y to both the pedicles, I'm making that cut up and I'm stopping in between the ears. So come back from the ears.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Stop there.
And then as far as any other in the field care mistakes that you see.
Yeah. The big thing, like I said, is the brisket. Again, don't salt the animals. It's not going to do anything. The thing that you run into with guys, especially if guys that are like out in the backcountry, is packaging. Mm-hmm. You know, so a lot of times around here with blacktails, if we're local, you know, we can get to a cooler, we can get back to our house within a reasonable amount of time. Where I've hunted in Idaho, you know, you're 8-9 miles in, you're going to have some, and it's going to be high heat, especially with bears. You know, you're going to have some. There are some tricks you can do. One is obviously we talked about getting that cool. Even if it's 70 degrees out and you can get that in a shaded area and get that kind of laid out, it will cool off significantly. Put it in we kind of talked about before the podcast, you know, don't use black plastic bags, but you can, once it's cooled off, put it in a black plastic bag, seal the top. If you have access to a creek, put that thing in the creek.
Okay.
Just don't let creek water get to it. So that's why it comes in.
What if it does?
If it does, you can have the bacteria level can start. So bacteria level usually starts promoting big time. Either it's wet or it's above 37 degrees. So if it gets wet, bring it out, drain it off, lay it out, let it kind of get dry, and then repackage it and put it in there. You can do that if you're in snow areas, pack it in a snowbank, you know.
Now what about, say you're elk hunting, Idaho, Montana, Colorado, wherever.
Yeah.
And you want to bring the head home.
Mm-hmm.
The trip, like, what are you concerned about? Like, time frames, you know, you kind of got a whole elk head and a cape.
Yeah.
Can't really put that in a cooler.
Right.
What's the best rule of thumb there?
So the weird thing about with most deer and elk and stuff is where they start actually having problems is from their inside of their mouth out. So you'll typically, if a cape has been removed and the head is still in it, you know, the back, everything from the back, usually where we start seeing degradation of that hide is right around the cheek level. So to keep that area cool, if you can prop the mouth open a little bit, what you're going to be fighting is you're going to be fighting flies or something like that, or maggots, where we're going to start that process even further. As far as timelines, you know, it there's so many variables. If you've got no wind and it's 70 degrees out, you got maybe a day or two. If you can get it cooled off, you probably have a couple days. If it gets really, really cold at night, set that bugger out and let it freeze. and then wrap it up, keep it in a black plastic bag and keep it in the shade someplace. You know, where we hunt in Idaho, it'd get 30 degrees at night and it's 75 degrees day in the daytime. So let that thing freeze at night, package it up, put it underneath of a tree someplace and, you know, keep it in there to keep probably for a couple days. Okay. That's kind of, you know, that's where I think down the road, if we offer something to teach guys how to take them off the skulls better, you're going to save a heck of a lot more caves.
Because in my scenario, I've got 7 to 10 days and we've got two tags.
Yeah.
Now, if I kill early,
right.
You know, I'm thinking now proactively, like maybe you find a cooler.
Yeah.
Like, hey, can I bag this thing up and bring it to you and get it cooled off?
Right.
And then pick it up on the way home.
Yes, some walk-in freezers where they'll offer you, allow you to put a cape in there, but usually it has to be pre-arranged.
Probably they don't because they don't want hair and stuff in their meat.
Yeah, unless you're bringing a meat where they're going to make money off it, they're not going to be too happy about $5 or $10 a day for a bunch of elk hair in their freezer.
I would probably end up bringing my meat as well because I dealt with that. I killed on day 4 out of day 8.
Uh-huh.
I didn't end up taking it to a cooler. We hung it, kept it cool by a creek at camp.
Yeah.
You know, it never really got super cold.
Yeah.
I had some good wind.
Yep.
God, I was a ball of mess, man.
Yeah.
Like, I was worried about that meat. Like, I wasn't going to shoulder mount it, but I just did a Euro, but I was so worried about that. So, guys, make a plan to do with your meat and or if, like, what if you run into a giant bull or a big buck that you want to mount?
Right.
You got to think about that. If you kill that bull or buck early, can't just let that hide or mount sit around.
Right.
So, try to think proactively in that sense. You know, another... I don't ask me or tell me if this is way out in left field or not, but couldn't you like bag it and then go get ice and do like a double bag type of deal?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. If you have a cooler, you know, you can double bag it, throw it in there and pack ice around. Absolutely. You just don't want water or ice coming in contact with the actual hide.
Okay.
You know, you can even, I know some guys, my cousin has done it. We've done it over the years. You know, when we go elk hunting, we'll take I have an enclosed trailer. We got a freezer in the back.
Yeah.
And then we just have a little generator. We turn that on, freeze everything hard, and then shut the freezer off, and you're good for a couple of days. But, you know, it just, not everybody has that ability. So.
That, but like, what about elk horns? You know what I mean? How do you?
Yeah. Yeah. So
I'm just thinking out of the box here because hunting out of state. I mean, it's kind of.
Yeah. No, especially. Yeah. You know, that therein lies the problem. That's why I have that instead of a chest freezer. So
no kidding. Right?
I'm pointing to my walk in freezer, you know. So
yeah.
Yeah.
That's huge.
Yeah. That's, you've got to be you got to be prepared for that, and a lot of people don't think about that if they get something good and bad. A lot of times if something does spoil or does go bad, it's not the end of the world. You know, a lot of taxidermists that are relatively busy will have extra capes, but then again, you don't want to get into the mindset of like, I'll let it go, I'll get an extra cape, because it's the year that you're going to need an extra cape for the 350 bull you just shot. The taxidermist is like, I don't have one.
You look at the year of COVID where there's so many more people out killing animals too.
Yeah.
So I'm sure this year was a little bit busy for you.
Yeah. 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 I take in a lot of blacktail capes, and that's,
You ever buy blacktail capes?
I do. Actually, what I do is, and that's something I try to get my hands on many of them because, I mean, the Pacific Northwest is really the true place, you know, Pacific Northwest and Oregon are have the true Columbia blacktails. California, I'm not bagging on you, but you guys' blacktails are not really blacktails.
Yeah, dude, we can't compete.
They're muley crosses. So yeah. I have a couple clients that go down there and they hunt August and they shoot these just gigantic masher blacktails and they call up and they want a late October Columbia blacktail cape to put to these
That's
horns.
Cheating,
oh
dude.
No, I'm not even joking.
That's
it happens
so cheap.
Yeah, every year. So, but yeah, to answer your question, I do. And usually, what I do is I'll buy a cape outright or. A really good thing that a lot of people do is you bring me in a usable blacktail cape from like a mature 2-point or better, and I will do the Euro in exchange for you for the cape.
That's a good deal.
So yeah. So it's a better deal for the client than it is for me necessarily, but it's just labor on my end, but I try and get my hand on as many as I can because I have couple really large taxidermy supply houses and stuff that want to buy Columbia blacktail capes from me. So they'll get them. And then I like having them on hand because there's a fair amount of people that they mess a cape up or.
Cause I'm going to have to buy one. Cause I told the wife I've shot a really big blacktail. I got shoulder mounted.
Yeah.
I shot a really nice, really, really nice 3-point.
Yeah.
I was like, I'll go Euro. But I told myself if I shoot another good one.
Yeah.
I'm going to make like a 3-piece blacktail corner mount.
Yeah.
So I'll have to buy one for the big 3-point.
Yep. There you go.
Which I should have kept his cape, but.
Yeah. And that's the thing is if people want to do that or if you are interested in selling a cape to a taxidermist or anything like that is a lot of times they're looking, like I said, they're looking for the big 2 points or better. And you know what I'm talking about. Like the mature 2 points, they just don't have the genetics to go further.
You'll know.
Yeah. And it's got nothing to do with the pedicle size. Everybody's like, his bases aren't real big. I don't care about the bases. It's that you can tell a mature deer from a young deer in the face.
Yep.
And when people come in, they want an extra cape. An average blacktail, mature blacktail, a 3-point or better, or a big two is going to be 20 inches in the neck. When they hit rut, you know, you're going to see the 21s, 22s. And the neck measurement I'm referring to, I don't want people going home and measuring all their bucks because it's kind of hard to understand. But it's essentially the narrowest point under the chin right behind the ears. And it's the narrowest point. I had a guy bring in a mule deer to me a couple years ago, and he's like, yeah, this thing's got a 36-inch neck on it. And I'm like, dude, that elk doesn't even have a 36-inch neck. Well, he was measuring it down by the shoulders.
Oh, okay.
And so he was thinking it was, you know, a little bit bigger than what it was. But so you want the maturity is what you're looking
on
for.
On the big one, I think I shot it was like 23 and a half, 24.
That's good. Yeah.
I'm telling you, it looked like he got his head stuck in a 5-gallon bucket.
I think the biggest blacktail I've ever taken in, it was up from, what was it? Some island.
Oh, dude. $100. Huh? Probably Vashon Island or Whidbey. Yeah, Whidbey.
26-inch neck on that thing. I had to order a mule deer form and do a blacktail change out head. This thing was a monster.
Yeah, I don't.
Monster.
I
24 is big.
It's very big.
Yeah.
It was like, I think I've got a video I can show you where it's just like, oh my God.
Yeah.
But
I think that buck up there, that full sneak up top, he's a 22 if you want to get any idea of how it
is. Mine's bigger than that.
Yeah. But oh, definitely. Yeah. 24 is a freaking stunner on a blacktail.
I'm telling you, this deer had to be 10 years old, dude. And just full genetic potential. I mean, it's a little bit on the back end, but I shot a buck that was 7.5, and this buck puts him to shame.
Yeah.
Like, I don't even know how to explain it. It's just unbelievable specimen.
That's awesome.
And he was like that chestnut color.
Yeah.
You know what I'm talking about. When you see a giant mature buck, they're not even the same color as other deer.
They don't. They go to that, I call it sienna. They have like a lot of sienna color in them, and they start getting kind of the flecking in their top, you know, on the black cap and stuff. Yeah. Yeah.
Beautiful animals.
Yeah.
And you can't beat them. And then when I shot my mule deer, they're like tan, like a creamy.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the bigger ones are really lighter colored.
Yeah.
But one fun thing I think you'll appreciate is when I shot that really big blacktail, this guy had, I don't know, 150 to 100 ticks on his brisket.
Oh,
right here.
Yeah. I love that.
I'm not joking. It looked like a beehive.
They do.
Have you seen that before in a lot?
That's, oh yeah. So you'll get people that will, they'll come in and they'll just be like, we don't have ticks on the west side. BS.
BS.
We got lots of ticks. And you're exactly right. Sometimes the older bucks, I'll see it. They will have, you'll run your hand over it and it will feel like, yeah, you know what I'm talking about. So I'll throw that thing in like a tumbler or something like that, or when I'm shaving the hide. And I mean, it looks like M&Ms laying on top of my table. Like they are just covered in it.
Now I have a theory on that.
Uh-huh.
That buck's probably just been laying there.
Yep.
In a creek bottom or perfect area.
I think that's a pretty valid assumption.
And hasn't been doing nothing.
Right.
And when you see a buck with that, you're like, this bull, he had it figured out.
Right.
And he didn't move until it was showtime.
Sure.
And then after that, he went back and
fed. Same. Yeah. They get nocturnal the more points they get.
Yeah.
So they just,
Absolutely. That was one of those things where you're like, no wonder we don't ever see these things.
Yeah. No, we got ticks here.
There's a lot of them.
Yeah. I used to hunt with a guy. You go out in the middle of the winter and it's like, how in the hell do you have a tick on you? I mean, if they were there, he got them.
Oh, man, dude. Yeah. It can be gnarly. I haven't really got a ton deer hunting. I got one stuck in me as a kid, but other than that, as far as coastal stuff, I don't know if they just don't like my blood or what.
I've been fortunate. I've doing this business, I've always thought that I would have one at least attached to me at some point or bitten, getting bit. I've seen more than I ever want to see.
God,
but
give me the heebie-jeebies, dude.
Yeah, the elk are really bad. You'll be caping out an elk in here, and there'll be ticks crawling on the floor. I'll usually send my two kiddos inside. I'm like, hey, go inside. I don't want you guys out here. I've never been bitten by one out here, but I probably just screwed myself saying that. So,
yeah.
But yeah, they're well and alive in Western Washington. So, and that's the other thing. You know, we were talking about some of the neck sizes and stuff too. That's something to tell your listeners too. Is we can't make them bigger than what they already are. So I know I know you really want that 24-inch neck on a little spike, but it ain't happening. So we cannot stretch them out any bigger than what they are.
Oh,
so.
That's good, man.
Yeah.
You were telling me before, you got bit by a grizzly, man.
I didn't get bit. I got chased.
Oh, you got
chased.
Yeah,
I got chased. He attacked me. But that's crazy. Yeah, so that was in Wyoming in 2010.
And you're saying you have some pretty bad luck with bears.
I do. I have a lot of bad luck with apex predators. I have been charged by a black bear. I have literally bumped into a black bear. I have been attacked by a grizzly. I have been chased by a moose. I had a cougar in my backyard that came that was within 35 feet of me for a long time. I mean, I just, the guys at work, they always joke around with me. They're like, dude, everybody's hunting them and they walk to you. Like you don't even have to do anything. So yeah, I don't know what it is. I must have a pork chopper on my neck or something.
What happened with the grizzly? Was it just did you bump into him or over a kill or what?
So we were mule deer hunting, and there was three of us guys there, guys from work, two other firefighters, and it was north. I guess it would be northwest Wyoming, just not very outside the park.
Oh, so you were asking for it.
Yeah. I was already in the lawn dart position, you know?
Jeez.
So, and we had seen grizzlies in the area. And the three of us essentially went to this new part of ground, and we all had different opinions as far as what we wanted to do for that day. So we just said, hey, we're going to split up. Ironically, when we were having this conversation, we looked up on this ridge and we could see a big grizzly looking down at us. And it's weird going from Western Washington, running into bears, and I've run into a lot of them. The bears around here, black bears don't even concern me. Like, mm-mm. they see you and they take off, you know. Over there, those grizzlies, they look at you and they just are like, huh. Like, it's just like, oh, you're in my spot. You know, they're not. Mm. So they're just a different animal altogether. Well, essentially, we split up. I went down. A good friend of mine, he went to the left up to a ridge. I went down the center of this canyon. There was a big field in the center of this canyon that we were told about. And then my other buddy went off to the right, kind of went over the backside of this hill and whatnot. And we had these three-way radios, and we could kind of talk. And it was one of those radios that every single time you transmitted it, did the beep, beep, you know. And so I got over this field, and I saw a buck up in a burn area right past the field. And I radioed to my buddy. I said, hey, I've got a buck over here. I don't know how big he is. I'm just kind of seeing him move through the timber. I'm going to shut the radio off because I don't want the beeping going on. They said, yeah, good luck. So I get in there, I get to the burn area, and I remember marking that spot where I last saw the buck. There was like a burnt stump. And so I got to the burnt stump, no buck, and I'm kind of looking around. Well, there was a slide area. I could tell about 100 yards to my left, there was a slide area that went up the ridge. And those deer, like in the last couple of days, they really like going to those slide areas. I don't know why, they just do. So I went out there and got to the slide area to the edge of this, and there was a stump, or there's a log that was about 3 foot off the ground. It went out of the slide area. So I hopped up on this log and I walked out to the edge, and I'm glassing up. And to this day, call it God, call it intuition, call it what you will, I will never forget it. It was like someone whispered in my ear and said, turn around. And I turn around, and here's a grizzly that's probably about, I'm guessing probably 70, 80 yards, and he's walking right at me. I mean, he's got his head down, but he's looking right at me. And I'm like, okay, you know, maybe he doesn't know I'm here. I vividly remember it all happened within seconds, but you take away little bits of everything that, you know, experiences that you have. And one of the things I remember was that his jaw was like swinging from side to side. I remember he had a big scar over the top of his nose. But I remember thinking, I first thought he knows I'm here, but I just didn't. I thought, well, maybe there's something else. We had gone, this was the fourth day of the trip. I had a .45 that I brought with me to keep for a bear gun. It was heavy after day two. I left it in the cabin. So here I am with a .30-06 with one in the pipe, two in the clip, and this thing is walking right at me. So I start kind of moving around thinking he doesn't see me. He still keeps coming. Just walking. He's not running. He's just walking. But he's coming across this whole slide area with sticks and blowdown. He's not making a sound. I mean, he never made a sound. So he gets to about 60 yards away, and I feel the wind hit me in the back of the neck, and I see his nose going. I'm like, all right, he knows I'm here. Mm-hmm. Like he can smell me. So I get the gun up at one point, and just to kind of see if I could see down in case this was going to go sideways, and all I can see was a brown blur. I almost grabbed my radio out, but I didn't want the beeping to alarm him. So he's now about 50 yards away, and he's still coming, and he's still got his head down, but he's making eye contact with me. And about 40 yards, I remember vividly thinking, I'm like, this is going to go bad for one of us. Like, he's definitely on a mission. At 30 yards, I remember reading some outdoor stories when I was younger about, you know, like, make yourself look big and yell at him and
yeah,
stuff.
Yeah, put your arms up and say, hey.
So I raised my gun about head level, and I went, hey, hey, hey. And right when I did that, he goes, woof, and he just starts full bore, full wide open. He covered 30 seconds. I mean, there was a log that was about 12 feet away from me, and it was lateral, and it was about 2 feet off the ground. And I at this point now, I had the gun off safe at my hip going, he clears that log, I'm touching around off. And he went over that log, and his front feet hit the ground, and I shot, and the bullet ended up going center chest, and it was just luck. I'm no great shot. And it went center chest, but it ended up coming out his sternum and zippering him open. So when he stood up to roar because he got hit, all his guts fell out of him. Wow. So he's standing there batting at his chest with his paws, roaring like you wouldn't believe. And at one point, he actually hooked, not to get too graphic, but he actually hooked one of his intestines up and over top of his nose as he was moving his paws around. He drops down. I don't remember working the action, but I fired off another shot. It was just kind of instinctual, I guess. Yeah. The field investigation showed that shot did not hit him. He dropped down on all fours. He started running. He paralleled me, dragging 5 feet of intestine behind him. Mm-hmm. He paralleled me. He got about 10, 12 feet, turned and came back at me again. Last shot in the gun. So I get the gun up, and I'm holding the gun. That's not even on my shoulder. I'm just looking down the barrel of the gun, and I touch a round off, and he spins 180 degrees and falls dead. And the field investigation showed I shot him about 3/4 to an inch above the right eye. They said if I had gone another 1/2 inch, it just would have bounced right off of him. And it was a last shot in the gun. So the field investigation showed where my shells were at when I ejected them. It was 8 steps from there to the bear. So I turned on the radio, and I'm still standing on this log. And this thing's, I mean, it just happened. The bear's still in front of me. And I'm thinking, this sucker's going to get up at any moment. And everybody's probably thinking, oh, yeah, did you crap yourself? No, I didn't crap myself. But, you know, the adrenaline started hitting. I started getting, like, sick and everything else. So being a firefighter, I knew I was kind of having a little bit of shock. So I got, like, some crackers out and started chewing on those. I turned on the radio, and I got a hold of Isaac, my buddy on the other ridge. And I said, hey, you guys got a copy. And he thought I was shooting at a deer. He didn't see anything. He just heard the shots. So he starts ribbing me. You know, he's like, geez, how many shots does it take to shoot a mule deer? So I get on there and I'm like, it's not what you think. I was like, I had a grizzly come after me. It's dead here in front of me. And he's like, oh, you know, when the radio keys open, you don't hear anything. That's how it was. He's like, what? So he looks over in the binoculars and can see me. I'm wearing an orange hat. And he's like, is that the bear in front of you? And I said, yeah. He goes, oh, my God. He goes, how close is that thing? It looks like you're standing on it. I said, yeah, he's pretty close. And he's like, well, put more rounds in. He goes, he could be alive, or there could be other ones in there. So to make a long story short, I packed out, left the scene. I left my battery. My battery started going dead on my radio. I actually shook my batteries out at the spot. I did not pick them up intentionally because I knew that there was a chance, you know, because they're still protected.
Yep.
Especially in 2010, they were really controversial then.
Yeah.
And I left everything there because I knew if this turned into an investigation, I at least wanted to show them where I was at. So we all met up at the trailhead. My other buddy, Brandon, he actually had heard the conversation on the radio, but his radio wasn't getting out. And so we all met back up there, and we met, and they basically said, you got two choices. He goes, we can never speak of this again, or we can go back and report it. And I'm like, I'll go back and report it. It's like, I wouldn't have done it. I mean, I'm talking like I'm fairly well put together then, but I was pretty still shaken up.
I could only imagine.
Yeah. We went back and called the game wardens. Game wardens, long story short, the game wardens came out. They talked to me about the thing. They were very neutral in the position. They just said, yeah, he was probably bluff charging. And I'm like, well, I wasn't going to let him cover the another 10 feet to let him figure it out. And they said, well, he probably wasn't that close. He always seemed closer. And so just kind of that, they weren't being jerks. They were actually very, very nice, very professional, very nice. But you could just tell they're very neutral in it. And when they got up there and saw the scene, they all looked at me and they're like, oh my God. They're like, when did you first see him? And I'm like, way over there. And they're like, where did you first shoot? And I'm like, right there. And the guy was like, I remember the bear biologist. He's also the game warden, but he's the bear guy for Wyoming. He turns around. He's like, dude, you should have been shooting a long time ago.
For real?
Yeah. And I'm like, well, I was trying to give him the benefit of the doubt. Yeah. Like, I didn't want it to. So they allowed us to keep hunting. They took all my information. I had to write a big statement up, all that kind of stuff. They said, you'll hear back in 10 months whether you're cleared. But from what we see, your everything was complete self-defense. 3 months later, I got a call from the Fed game, and they're like, yeah, you're cleared. They said, yours is one of the most clear-cut cases of self-defense. 2 days later, after my incident, they had a guy get mauled just not very far from where we were. He was an outfitter. He took a guide, or took a client in, came back, dropped his saddle, walked his horse back to the trailer, went back to get his saddle, and a grizzly was waiting for him, and he got mauled. He survived. But
at a trailhead?
He got mauled. Yeah, it was at a trailhead.
They say sometimes those are the worst because people leave trash or food or kind of congregate.
Yeah, well, that's what he was thinking because he has a saddlebag with like snacks and stuff in it. And he said he gets there and there's a bear waiting for him and then it got a hold of him. So,
unbelievable. That's my worst nightmare, dude.
Yeah, I would do it differently. I want to go back to Wyoming really bad. I'm still trying to convince my wife to let me do it. I would do it differently. I'm not saying it would be really hard to get me to camp in grizzly country. I will hunt it, but I will hunt it very differently. Okay. The big argument, and this is a whole other conversation of itself, but you know, that was, I got asked the big argument. Oh, well, didn't you have bear spray? You know, the big argument between bear spray and guns. Well, would bear spray have worked on that bear? According to the biologist, no.
He's coming.
What they found out about that bear was that he was 25 years old. They think he came out of Yellowstone. He was missing hardly any teeth. The jaw that I told you about that was swinging, he had a broken jaw. He had hardly any claws left. He was only about 450 pounds when we had to pack the whole thing out. Yes, we had to pack the whole thing out.
You guys did?
Yeah. Wow. Yeah, because they have to put on a tarp because they send it to a lab and they do a necropsy. So they can basically tell how you shot that animal, the position you were in and everything. So if you're lying, they can tell.
Yeah. Yeah.
So they had to do that. And so they came back and they said it was only about 450 pounds and he was starving. They said even if he had made the den, he wouldn't have woke up. And they said, but based upon his head size and his bone structure, which I vividly remember how big his head was when I walked up to him. I didn't take any pictures of him because if they went through my stuff, you know, when we contact, I didn't want it seeming like I was taking trophy pictures or anything. And I was just freaked out. I just wanted to be out of there.
I don't blame
him. So they said he was about 700 to 800 pounds the previous year. So, and they just said he was on an entirely different wavelength. It was get food and belly any way you can. So that's what the game warden said, is he's like, I don't think bear spray would have done a thing with him. So yeah. he was on an elementary drive, and that was to get food, and it didn't matter what it was. So,
man.
So I carry both. That's my moral of the story, is carry both.
Damn, dude. I'm gonna shot off 12 games with me. Yeah, because we had talked about, like, you know, you want to go to Wyoming or Montana.
Yeah.
You know, I want to. I just don't know how I'm going to deal with it because I'll be honest with you. I haven't really said anything on this on the podcast. I got spooked in Idaho.
Yeah.
Even though there's not really that many, there's bears in Idaho.
But, yeah.
We're heading over on the drive over. We're just about to cross the Idaho state line and we get a ding email. Mm-hmm. Idaho Fish and Game. Two hunters mauled. I'm like,
there was a gal mauled 2 days ago in Montana. Did you see that? Killed.
Like in grizzly the city bear. Limits almost.
Yeah. Yeah. They got to figure out something.
My buddy, I was just listening to a podcast today at work or on the way here, Dan Staten and John Barklow.
Yeah.
He's like, I've been around grizzly bears in Alaska and I've been around grizzly bears in Montana.
Yes.
I don't fuck around with the bears in Montana. They're different because they don't have any fear for humans.
Yeah, so when I went to taxidermy school, that's the guy that was teaching, his name was Jeff Welch, master taxidermist. This guy is a mule deer killing machine. He's gotten 4 bucks over 200 inches.
Man.
He has said the same thing because they have family up in Alaska. And he said the lower 48s, he goes, they are an entirely different bear. And he has two theories. One, he said they're not hunted, so there's no fear of man. And two, he said they don't hibernate near as long, if any.
Yeah.
So he said they're constantly mad and grouchy anyway. Mm-hmm. But he said the same exact thing. He goes, those lower 48s, he goes, you do not mess with them. He goes, they are meaner than hell. So he said he has been on an opposing ridge and seen a hunter shoot at a deer, you know, 3/4 mile over, and he will watch the bear literally run to the gunshot. So, and that's what the game wardens told us when they interviewed me, and they said, yeah, hey, you know, you guys are going to continue to hunt. We're like, yeah. I told my buddies, I was like, hey guys, call me a wuss, call me whatever name you want in the book. I really don't want to hunt by myself anymore. Can I stick with one of you guys? And they're like, yeah, no problem. But the game wardens told us, they said, if you guys get a deer down in the backcountry, because we were packing in 3 or 4 miles at least every day, he said, if you get one down, one guy stands guard. And I'm not talking like looking up every now and then. One guy stands guard.
Defense position.
And the other guy work on the deer. And if you can't get it out in one load, don't come back for the rest of it. They said, bone it out, get it out in one load, don't go back. Because there's a really good chance. When we went up to the bear that I shot, when we got up there, the game wardens got out of the truck and they all, I mean, they looked like they were getting ready for war. Like they got out, they were checking all their sidearms. Each one of them had a slung shotgun and a shotgun in their hand. And we get about, probably about 100 yards from the site and they start yelling. They're all like, hey bear, hey bear, hey bear. And I'm like, hey guys, he's dead. They're like, no, you don't understand. The last bear that we went on that was shot by a hunter, we got in there and there was 5 grizzlies eating on it.
God, dude. This is in 2010.
This is 2010.
11 years ago.
Yeah. Yeah. And there's more there now. I'm changing your mind about Wyoming. I'm not trying to. you have to be smart about it. That's the big thing. You have to be smart. I will always hunt with someone pretty close by. I will never.
Dude, I would be like tying rope off to each other. Like, you didn't hit me, dude.
I won't ever go like that brush. That's the thing that scared me the worst is that bear knew I was there when I was in that deep reprod. If he, and that's what the game warden told me. He goes, I'm not trying to scare you. He goes, if he caught you in there,
you wouldn't have any time to react.
Yeah. It would have been game over.
There was a girl biologist that got chomped by a really, really old bear.
Yeah. Did you listen to that podcast?
Yeah.
Yeah. That was a good one.
That was a good one.
So that same bear, they think that similar bear or 2 years ago, do you hear about the two elk hunters in Montana? They got attacked. Mm-hmm. So those are two guys I know. And
then Neil, do you know Neil?
Yep. Yeah. Neil Rico. Oh, yeah.
I'm going to talk about his story one of these times.
Yeah. Yeah. He's a good dude. He's a client of mine. He was just in here not too long ago. His boy shot a really nice mule deer. And so I did a real cool habitat plaque and stuff for him. And so we were comparing stories and stuff. Mm-hmm. Those two guys in Montana, I know those two guys. And they were as well equipped as you can possibly imagine. I don't want to go too much into their story, but essentially they were walking down trail elk calling. And they both had pistols on their chest and they had bear spray. No time.
Yeah.
They heard a snap and they turned around and this bear was knocked one of them off the trail and then started chomping on the other one. I mean, no time. So, and it's just, and they think that was the same bear because it was in the same area. They think that bear was responsible for 3 different attacks that occurred within that same timeline in that general area.
Crazy.
So they think, and they never found it. Well, they shot one that they think potentially was it, but the other one, they don't know. So
I work with a Montana game warden. He came over here from Montana and he says, you think you're going to have a chance? He says, you have no chance to react. The only time you'd have a chance if you see him from a couple hundred yards away and you get ready.
Yeah.
Other than that, you're going to be thinking, your mind's going to be on something else, whether you're tired, you're elk or whatever. And then next thing you know, you're going to get tackled by a middle linebacker.
Yeah. And the movie that came out? The Revenant, Leonardo DiCaprio, you know, when he gets attacked.
Yeah.
I've had guys at work, we watch that at work, and guys will ask me, they're like, do they really move that fast? Yes, absolutely they do. Those things are ferociously fast.
Yeah.
I'm talking like, one, I'll still be amazed at how quiet that animal was, and two, how fast that thing moved. I mean, it was unbelievable. So, but it's the same with cats. I have a wife that always asks me, she goes, how come you don't pack a sidearm when you go out shedhorn hunting in Western Washington? And I'm like, because the only thing I'm concerned about is a cat. She goes, well, why don't you take it then? The only time I did take a sidearm was that one at incident I told you about with that other bear. But the cat, I'm like, it's the grizzly bears and cougars are the same thing. If they have ultimately made their mind up to get you,
they're going to get you.
There's not a whole lot you're going to do about it. You're hoping for a quick searing pain and the lights go out. If not, it's...
Yeah, I haven't had too many run-ins with cougars here, but it's, I'll carry it. You know, a lot of times it's just, it's more of a, because I hunt solo a lot. Mm-hmm. So it's more of a creature comfort of like, if you do get spooked.
Right,
you can put your hand on it, make it feel good at least.
Make it feel, it's a feel good.
That's about it. So let's wrap this up a little bit. But I want to wrap it up with what do you got? Do you have anything else for us?
I think we kind of covered everything. Okay. So,
and then what are your plans for hunting this year?
So I have I'm going up on a bear hunt. I got invited to go up on a bear hunt to Forks with an outfit up there.
Cool.
I'm kind of showing them some tricks and skinning techniques and things like that. And so they're doing a bear hunt with that on the same time. So I'm really looking forward to that because that place has sent me clients for a number of years, and they get some. There's some pretty good ones up there.
There's a lot of bears.
Yeah, and they have a lot of private access too. So, okay. The guy sent me a text the other day and is like, dude, it's a late rut. He goes, they're still running around like crazy around here, which I believe him. We went up in the hills the other day. I went up there with the family just in the afternoon, and we saw a bear right in the middle of the road. Like, mm-hmm. I'm like, what are you doing here? So anyway, to get back to hunt. So I've got that plan. I've got a moose, wolf, black bear, and deer, hopefully, trip planned for BC in October.
Are they going to let you in?
Huh? Hopefully they didn't let us in last year, which is when we were supposed to go.
Okay.
Hope they're going to let us in, and then it depends on whether or not they do the whole vaccination route or not.
Okay.
And then archery elk here for Western Washington. That's going to be kind of up in the air as far as where I'm going right now, because the area that I had been going to, it's changed quite a bit. Okay. I'm not going to get into where I'm going, but there was a smaller gate where I went essentially, or virtually no gate, and they all of a sudden decided to open that up as a main line, and now everybody knows about it. So it kind of got
blown up.
It got blown up.
Happened to my blacktail spot.
Yeah.
There was like a no gate deal, and yeah. I didn't see two people. I saw the same dude twice in 3 years.
Mm-hmm.
Now it's...
And the topography's changed. You know, the stuff that was more clear cuts, now it's that thick dog hair that you're not even going to think about going in. I mean, they love it. They're in there. But the numbers, I was in there the last 2 years, and the numbers just... They've moved. They're not gone. They just change areas.
Yeah.
So that, and then I have a multi-season deer. We'll see what happens. So I got a good buddy that runs a hunting outfit up in Eastern Washington. Anybody that draws a moose tag, man, he is the man to call. He knows moose up there. I mean, like, I got, I think, 8 or 9 Washington bulls in last year, bull moose, oil tags. And I can send him pictures of that bull moose, and he'll send me 3 years of trail cameras of that specific moose.
Wow.
So he's got there's a new world record up there. So, or a new Washington record up there. And he sent me pictures of it.
Wasn't,
and it's
there
impressive.
One?
There was a couple years ago. In fact, that clear cut that guy shot that in, we whitetail hunted in a tree stand a couple hundred yards from that.
Okay.
So my buddy called me and he's like, remember that clear cut? I said, yeah. He's like, that's that clear cut, that moose. I'm like, no way.
Wow.
And that's when he sends me the picture of the other one. And the other one, it's freaking stupid big. So
now, but, no out of state this year.
No out of state this year. Well, Montana. We'll see what happens.
Did you get drawn?
No.
I didn't get drawn either.
Yeah. So I put in with the Titan Outdoor guys every year. I'm part of Titan Outdoors with Chris Meyer and that whole group. I'd love to have those guys come up and do a podcast with you to talk about the kids hunt that we do.
I was going to go into that, but we'll probably save that for that. But I've known Chris for a long time because he used to live next to my grandparents back when he lived out in Adna or Boisford. But
well, we should arrange that. We can all meet back up here and talk about it. Those are a lot of the kids' rams from 2 years ago.
Yeah, that's a super cool deal that's going on.
That is insane. That is a reach out that more people need to know about.
That's what this is all about.
Yes, absolutely. So anyway, I put in with them. There's usually a group of us. They invited me to go with them several years ago. There's, you know, as most people know, you can only have a certain amount of number in a group for a put in.
Yep.
One of the guys' daughters decided to come this year. And so I'm like, yeah, no problem, man. I'll just put in separate. You know, I haven't, you know, my odds are good, you know, all that kind of stuff. Yeah, they all drew and I didn't.
Oh, no.
So I'm on the alternates list right now, and we'll see what happens.
The deer tag is usually, I've seen a lot of people get deer tags. Because you can wait so long.
Yeah.
So I'm on an alternate list for an elk tag.
Yeah.
They still haven't finalized the list yet.
No, they haven't. I'm waiting for it. Everybody, all the guys there, Chris and Skyler and Svein, all of them keep asking me, like, what number are you? I'm like, dude, they haven't told me yet. I don't know what it is yet.
I keep looking at it. But from what I've heard is, like, they keep getting, like, I've seen guys that will get tags in October.
Yes.
So that's something to look at.
Yeah. I'm hoping something will happen, but we'll see what happens. So hopefully that will go. I'm not sure yet, though. And then just stuff around
local
here.
Stuff.
So, yeah.
It's always fun hunting around home.
Yeah.
You get to spend more time there.
Yeah. The problem with this is this business. You know, if you like hunting, don't get into taxidermy.
That's what I was going to say. How do you juggle all this? And then being a family man as well.
Yeah.
And then all that. So,
yeah, that's the hard thing. I've got an extremely patient wife. But yeah, I think I took in about 700 animals last year. So it keeps me pretty darn busy.
Wow. And you don't have anybody.
No, I don't. So we're in the new facility here. It's a lot bigger. I thought when I built this place that I would hire someone.
Mm.
and this is relaxing to me. And absolutely no offense to anybody that's come in that's offered to want to come in and work for me, is I kind of like working by myself. Yeah. I would rather take in less clients and or less contracts and do it myself than I would others. The other thing too is I've got just enough OCD in me that I would watch someone else putting it on the form and I'd just be like, now we need to fix it. And it wouldn't necessarily be something bad. It's just not quite my, you know, thing.
You ever thought of like having an intern?
I have. I have had a couple people come in and ask for that. The thing about it is with the taxidermy process, I know we're trying to wrap this up, but the thing with the taxidermy process, a lot of times people will come in and they'll see the fun stuff that's going on. They'll see the deer that's going on the form. And that what most people don't understand with taxidermy is it's a lengthy process. It's a very dirty process for the first half of it, at least. And a lot of times when you talk about doing that, they're like, yeah, I don't know if I want to do that. Well, then you probably shouldn't be a taxidermist. So that, you know, that I think shies a lot of people away. And then the people that have offered to come in an internship, a lot of times they're hunters that are really interested in it. And they're just like, yeah, dude, I'll come in an intern for you, but I can't be there during the month of, you know, September through November. It's like, well, dude, that's when I need you the most. Yeah. You know, if I can have someone here caping bucks out, and like I told you before, end of October last year, I had two tables here. I had 30 bucks sitting there that I was trying to get caped out and in the freezer and get marked up and tagged and everything else.
And you got to get them done.
Yeah. Yeah. You don't, you know, you got, you have the cooler.
Your hands, dude. My hands cramp up after doing some of that stuff.
I've got so many scars on my hand. It is unbelievable. I can't, my left hand, because I'm right-handed, so I hold the knife in my right. The ends of all my fingers on my left hand, I don't even have any feeling left
in
the ends.
You're slowly cutting them off.
Yeah. Oh yeah. I'm just, you know, I've cut my fingers and my hands more times than one. I've gotten better over the years. Usually it doesn't happen very often, but man, that first 3 or 4 years, dude, I had some whoppers. I was in the ER several times getting stitched up.
No way.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
Crazy.
Yep. So,
Where can people find you and how can they get a hold of you?
Yeah. So I have a Facebook page. I have an Instagram page, Black River Taxidermy for Instagram, Facebook, the same thing. Be careful. There's two Black River Taxidermies on Facebook. One of them is in North Dakota and one of them is in Washington. We're appropriately named, or I'm appropriately named Black River Taxidermy because I live on the Black River, which is some of the best waterfowl hunting in the Western Washington until that magazine article came out years ago, but it's still pretty darn good. And then I have there's a website too, blackrivertaxidermy.com.
Okay.
And you can go and look, a lot of photos on there. I have an update. We just updated the price list. Unfortunately, some of the prices went up on some stuff in there. And then I am one of those, you know, some of the biggest, again, I'm not naming names or anything for taxidermists, but one of the two complaints you hear about taxidermists is one is they take too long. And then the other thing is communication. I was a customer of a client of taxidermy for years. Took my stuff to several different people, so I know the frustration. I have strived very, very hard to not be like that. So usually if you get a hold of me via a message or something like that, it's very rare for me not to get back with you within 12, 24 hours.
Okay,
so I'm always good for a phone call. I love chatting with people. Usually I'm working on a deer when I do, so if it sounds kind of weird, I got the earbuds in. But that's the big thing with people listening is I'm not here to get business. I got plenty. If you have questions or if you have anything about cuts or anything like that, don't go into a season not knowing it and trying to figure it out in the field and then taking it in and messing it up. Ask your taxidermist, whoever you use. If you don't have someone, you just want some general idea, dude, I got it. My phone number is listed on all those pages. Give me a call. I have no problem talking to you or even stop in. I've got, you know, capes and stuff laying around that I can show you how to make a cut, you know, talk about some stuff. And then I love hearing people's stories. So that's what's so freaking cool about this. So
now where would be a good place for somebody to kind of get some info on that going into the season? Like, does your Facebook page have any of that?
Or? Yeah. So usually at the start of the prompt of every season, so like bears coming up, spring bear, I did it. I did a live feed on Facebook. And then I also showed some diagrams of the difference between like what we call a belly cut or a rug cut versus a dorsal cut for a bear. And it talks about how you would use them in different circumstances, different types of mounts. The same I'm going to do coming up here at the end of July, probably a couple days before, I'll do it again. I'll post it on there. Same with Instagram. I'll show the cuts and everything else. Same with deer. We'll kind of talk about some cuts and diagrams. You can look online and generally get a good idea as far as what they're looking for diagrams. Just, again, I can't preface it enough. Check with your taxidermist before you just do what you saw online, because your taxidermist may want it different from how what those diagrams are. But those are general ideas. So
what you're saying is we need to come here during hunting season and shoot a video.
Come on. You guys should come in here anyway.
Yeah.
You know, you come here like the end of October. You guys want to see some blacktail?
Yeah.
You guys
are
blacktail freaks? Oh, my gosh. I already showed you some of them, and some of the best ones are already out.
Yeah.
So there's some whoppers.
And they're cool. They're super unique, man.
Yeah.
Naughty, gnarly, bumpy, all over the thing.
They're the prettiest. Yeah. I think the only deer prettier than a Columbia blacktail is probably a Sitka. But as far as like Columbia blacktails, they're one of the most unique. They're one of the most, I think, regal. And they have all the characteristics that are really cool. But they still have the small ears and the beautiful capes. But they still got the big bulldog face. So, I mean, they're
cool.
Smart. They're super, super smart deer.
Stupid smart.
Yeah.
They'll watch you be dumb.
Yeah.
They'll watch you walk right by them.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, all right, fellas. Thanks for tuning in with us this week. Make sure you guys find us on the Instagram and the website. We do have t-shirts and a couple of sweatshirts. You can check out the website or just message me and see if I got your size. All the pre-orders are shipped out and they're heading to you guys. You guys actually should have them by the time this comes out. But yeah, if you guys want to hear of anything on as far as the podcast, what you guys want to hear, we do have the waterfowl ones coming up. So let me know what you guys want, because we're doing it for you. And have a good rest of your day, and we'll see you on the next one.